there, and they're closest to the people most impacted. So we agreed that our design process would center the lived experience of those most impacted and incorporate and uplift those voices as we began the planning process. We chose a design process centering lived experience, which we'll talk about here soon. The $20,000 went for stipends for 9 design team nonprofits, which included them bringing along their participants into the process. We started the work in 2018, summer of 2018. We had a community meeting to start recruiting for the design team, and we had a kickoff meeting which Mayor Ted Wheeler attended and is on the picture above, November of last year. We had 6 design team meetings, 1 community forum to gather even more information, and came up with the blueprint you see in front of us. Had it not been for the participation of those most impacted, with those having what we call our lived experts, we wouldn't have come up with something that I feel more represents a solution that we need to respond to.
Great. So the list in front of you are all the design team partners. It was a true public nonprofit collaboration with all different communities represented through these groups. And so we're really proud that everyone came together to have these hard conversations in Landra.
Thank you. When writing the City Grant, START grant, the Multnomah Ideal Lab led the design team through a human-centered design process in order to develop the blueprint. Human-centered design is a process that starts with end user at the heart of the process by creating new solutions to suit their needs. The HCD focuses on building a deeper empathy for the client to create innovative, effective, and sustainable solutions. Most importantly, it shifts the paradigm of how decision-making usually happens. For us, this entailed many challenging conversations, hearing different experiences from different people can be heavy. As you can see, there were a ton of sticky notes from different people sharing from different communities of color. Personally, I agreed to join the design team because I wanted to be a voice for the foundational Black Americans. Our poverty is viewed as a moral issue, but the truth is our poverty is due to unjust laws, corruption, banking industries, and a host of other broken promises and a host of other acts.
At the heart of the human-centered design is creating a design question that seeks to develop solutions for, keeping in mind that racial identity continues to be a major predictor of economic success. Our design team wanted to prioritize addressing the racial wealth gap. In Portland, African Americans and Native Americans are overrepresented in the houseless population, and communities of color continue to experience income and wealth disparities. For example, in Portland, almost 1 in 4 Latinx and Native Americans live in economic poverty. And this number is worse for African Americans, of which almost 1 in 3 live in economic poverty. After much ideation, our team came up with the design question. How might we create an opportunity for economic empowerment within systems in our community that contribute to the elimination of the racial wealth gap? Comprised of people with lived experience, our design team felt like we were positioned to try to answer this tough question. After creating our design team question, we went through a period of ideation. This involved brainstorming, hosting a community forum, filling out many sticky notes, sharing experiences, working together to prioritize strategies. Ultimately, we developed 4 categories of recommendations that each have sub recommendations. Many of these recommendations have work already in progress, spearheaded by public and or nonprofit entities. We will now walk you through these recommendations. Our first recommendations are around system change. The City of Portland and Multnomah County do not have a centralized authority that oversees financial empowerment policy and programs. Our financial empowerment team recommends that the financial empowerment work have a centralized home one government body or department that will oversee the financial empowerment work happening across the city. Next, one of the goals of Portland Means Progress, PMP, an initiative conceived of and overseen by the Mayor's Council of Economic Advisors, is to address economic inequalities for communities of color. We see an opportunity for the financial empowerment team to provide recommendations on how PMP can expand to advance financial empowerment goals, particularly in how the private sector can play a role in addressing economic inequalities. Three, currently there are several efforts underway to handle record expungement. However, it is not clear how all of these efforts align and if these efforts have a clear racial justice lens. There are opportunities to examine more system-wide efforts for expungements. An example is a San Francisco effort to automatically expunge prior marijuana convictions. There's an opportunity for the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team to evaluate the effectiveness of the expungement services and their alignment with culturally specific and responsive approaches. Four, a study of the color of wealth in Multnomah County will provide insights to policymakers and community organizations who seek to address barriers to equitable attainment of wealth and assets related to race and support the county's Prosper Portland and Metro's racial justice agenda. Efforts are underway to obtain the resources needed to conduct such a study, which will replicate methods used in a survey produced through the Federal Reserve, Duke University, and the New School. Lastly, the design team feels that any ongoing advocacy work should reflect the equal importance of getting cash into the hands of individuals in addition to financial counseling once City Council Financial Empowerment Team established. We would like to spend time reviewing national studies and local examples of effective programs and develop a policy and program wish list for adding cash transfers as a strategy that complements existing financial empowerment programs.
And so our next bucket of recommendations, three more to go. And I was very pleased to hear Mayor Wheeler that this is a priority for you, because this fines, fees, and debt emerged as one of the top priorities of our design team. Everybody felt that this was, out of everything, one of the most important things to address. So our recommendations around fines, fees, and debt are threefold. One is to expand legal services days. So in Multnomah County, every other month, a legal services day is held at the Rosewood Initiative to help people with outstanding court debt, and we think that this is a really promising model. People with court-imposed fines and fees can participate in community service and or treatment to have their debts forgiven at a rate of 1 hour per $100 of debt. The volunteer judges, public defenders, and district attorneys serve about 130 people per clinic, and there's always people camping out the night before to get served. So it's clear that there is huge demand for this, and that this is a great solution or an interim solution before the systemic change happens. And so we would like to see this solution expanded, and we recommend that the city convene a legal service day collaboration to develop scale-up scenarios for the program and consider a city-county budget ask as needed in 2020-2021. The second is more of conducting an analysis of fines and fees and where the city has jurisdictional authority, and a budget analysis of income generated and cost to administer. And so San Francisco completed a study like this, and we think that it would be very feasible to replicate their study. The city and the county will then have the information to update the municipal predatory collection structure that is creating a disproportionate amount of harm for poor people and people of color in our community. The last is something that is a low-hanging fruit. Before this bill even came out, our team identified ending the practice of suspending driver's licenses for inability to pay and reinstate those affected by the current policy. And luckily, we don't have to handle this at a city level. There's a state bill coming out right now. It is HB2614, which ends step-based driver's license suspension. So we urge all of you to come out in support of this bill.
Has the bill, is there currently a bill sponsor, and is there a bill that will be introduced?
Yeah, there's a bill, actually, Carlos, do you know if they have an actual sponsor? There's many supporting organizations.
Yeah, I know the Oregon Law Center is leading the charge. I can't remember off the top of my head who the sponsors are. I should know
okay,
this.
No.
I will
respect you
on that. A one-pager on it.
And they're planning to introduce it in the 2020
yes.
session.
Yep,
very good.
Short session. Yes.
Okay, sorry for the interruption.
A key driver of racial wealth gap is the exclusion of people of color from mainstream financial institutions. We seek to not only increase access to financial institutions so that residents can access bank accounts, saving products, and safe and affordable credit, but in the long term to transform the system to more closely resemble the needs of residents of color and low-income residents, so that it is proactively prioritized wealth accumulation in these communities. Our design team identified key ways of fostering financial inclusion. I won't go too deep into detail on these recommendations because there are many, but I wanted you to know that most of these recommendations build upon the strength of existing efforts. I'm currently a financial coach and a credit counselor from present of August of this year till up until probably this week. I've probably seen close to 100 clients who lack the basic knowledge of paying on their debts on time, how to take care of a bank account, just basic knowledge with building access, assets, and et cetera, just in that whole financial literacy. Maybe I've come across 5 clients who truly understand what it means to pay their bills on time and the effects that will, the impact that it'll have if they don't. So with that being said, recommendations is to explore avenues to systemize youth financial education so that Oregon residents are learning key life skills before they have to learn the hard way and sit with me and learn how to repair the damage. Ensure quality financial education that is culturally specific through strategies such as creating a community of practice for financial education, coaches, mentors, and hiring community curriculum designers and facilitators. And number 3, increase accessibility of financial education tools and resources through centralized information and calendar, and perhaps a funding pool to employ culturally specific mentors to help clients navigate the financial empowerment services. And better to integrate referrals to wealth building tools and resources.
So we've just shared with you a bunch of recommendations. Oh, sorry, one more.
Last one. One of the biggest barriers, again, that we've heard from our practitioners, we already have a vast amount of community-based organizations that are doing this work in this space, but several issues came up. One, obviously, that there's not enough resources. This is a space that's not well-funded, and when it is funded, it's episodic. We also have multiple funding streams that require multiple, with multiple funders that have varying requirements with specific conditions for the allowable use of the resources. So we do believe that there's an opportunity for alignment to get all the funders together, including philanthropy, to help address this issue. So our recommendations, one is for the Oregon Asset Builders Coalition, which we convene at a state level to host the Oregon Financial Empowerment Summit, Funder Summit, to bring funders together to elevate this conversation and see how we can better align investments and a broader strategy. There's also work happening at the state level with the Oregon Housing and Community Services and DHS also convening a roundtable around poverty that we would like to include as well. Explore ongoing community practice model. Again, this has been addressed, but an opportunity for practitioners to come together to share best practices to be able to continue and sustain the work. And then the last piece is centralized data for outcomes and outputs. Again, we have a number of different organizations with different databases with different requirements. We do think there's an opportunity to align these to better tell the story through data of the successes that we're having with coaches and counselors like Londra and all the great work that she does.
Great. So we've shared with you many of our recommendations. We wanted to provide some next steps for action. And just to preface this, 2 years ago, public entities in Portland weren't explicitly talking about financial empowerment. And now they are, but we just need a way of continuing that coordination and discussion and planning. And through this model, this human-centered design model, we feel like we know how to solve these problems. We just need the resources to make them work, and we have a committed team that's centering those that are most impacted by the systems. And we really believe that this is the only way to move solutions forward and get real change in the city. So our prioritization of action is one, just a general, we know that the city is doing a lot to center racial justice, but a reminder that there is always more to do in the current system and future investments. The big ask for our team is really to find a home base for centralization of financial empowerment, and this would mean finding a department or agency and funding a full-time staff person that's dedicated to overseeing these efforts in the city. The third is we have our team that's still really engaged, and the blueprint is meant to be the underpinnings of a plan, and so we want to have the resources to be able to take this blueprint and turn it into something that can be implemented, and that means stipends for the families that participated to share their ideas and recommendations and expertise around implementation. And then intentionally engage with the elimination and reductions of fines and fees, as you stated, is a priority, and that's a big priority for our team. And so we'd love to continue these conversations with you all, and we really appreciate your time and look forward to your questions about this work.
Colleagues, any questions on the report?
Well, I'm
Commissioner Fish.
First of all, thank you for the report. I guess my questions are, you're clear about sort of action steps, but I'm less than clear about what our role is and what you're asking of us. And
I don't have money.
Well, that's part of it, is I guess resources. So could you be more explicit about what it is that you're asking us to do?
I think one of the initial ones is that there is a model around the country, around the cities for financial empowerment, where there is an opportunity for the city, for local governments to uplift that. I think from previous experiences with other cities, jurisdictions, there is power that comes with the city or the city council saying this is an important issue, and we're going to help coordinate. So that's looked differently in different cities, but to have a one-stop shop, for example, around everything financial empowerment related, so everything from utility assistance to anything that the city funds that's financial, that would have an impact on someone's financial, affordable housing, tax preparation, that would be centralized in a place where residents can go and get that support in one place and not in 10, 12 different nonprofits from across the state. So it is a way to be able to centralize that work and make it easier for the end user to receive any number of city assistance that the city might have.
And just also to clarify, there's so many rich services that like Carlos mentioned, that are already existing in Portland, and we're not asking for the city to create those services in duplication, but to serve as a centralizing force so that residents can access the services in a more easy manner.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. I would think that you talked about fees and fines, but you didn't talk about expungements, or I missed it. Did you talk about expungements at all?
Yes.
Somebody did. Okay. If we would do, that's right, you did talk about the clinic that happens at Rosewood Initiative. I did the first project, Clean Slate, a lifetime ago, where there was an opportunity for people to come and just get all their fines removed. They did community service. We had judges. We had lawyers. People came from all over the country because of how it impacts people's ability to get housing, employment, et cetera, et cetera. And so I would. So one question is, why aren't we asking the legislature to just pass a law that would remove the marijuana convictions from many, many, many folks in our community who are still struggling with getting housing, education, and all the other things that are associated with that. You've gone to little fines as compared to the expungement, which I think has a much bigger impact on people's ability to be financially independent.
Yeah, I think many of these solutions are maybe our best implemented, or some of them, like expungement, as you call that, would be best implemented at a state level, and same with the driver's license issue. So I think that's a point well taken, that, you know, not all of this is on the city, but we would like to have a home base that is advocating on behalf of Portlanders to make sure that this is happening within the city and for broader residents.
So I personally don't see how the city should have an office and have a staff person, because we have a couple of things in the city. We've had one person, right? And it's a really, really hard job when you're one person. I'm much more interested, if you said we have all these resources, which I don't know exist in our community, why don't we consolidate all those resources into one organization or one umbrella so that you can do what you want to do? I just feel like people ask government to do a lot that we can do ourselves, right? So why not consolidate and actually create a mega organization or a council that actually could help share this information broadly?
Yeah, you know, the whole premise behind the Cities for Financial Empowerment is giving these, the rich work that's going on within the community, more credibility through and just strength through the government expressing that it's a priority. And I don't think we would want to consolidate all these organizations. We all represent different organizations that have that serve very different cultural needs for communities, and they've been cultivated over time to make sure that they're really honed into the needs of their communities. But because all these different community-based services exist, it's hard for, and then we're all competing for funding, it's hard for us to coordinate our work and make sure that residents are getting the services that they, going to the right place. And I'll just space for
anyone. Well, let me just add that I think sometimes I'm happy that you think government gives it credibility, because we don't hear that a lot, that somehow if government puts a stamp on it, then all of a sudden it's a good thing, right? So I appreciate that you feel that way. So you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just an opportunity to uplift and bring the various nonprofits, the various work that's happening at a more systematic level. Again, I you know, from my vantage point, there we go. There's a lot of individual work that happens with the local nonprofits, and that we need a better, more systematic, more strategic approach to how we are going to do this as a community. And so there may be a resource, a program, a counselor that NAIA has that some other organization might not have. And so how do we all work together and coordinate and put, again, that saver or that individual or that participant at the middle, and then have a system that then supports all of the great work that's happening, whether it's coming through NAIA, whether it's coming through Hacienda, whether it's coming through MFS, there is an opportunity for us to better coordinate our response to the needs that families are having to deal with day in and day out.
So one thing that I think is very helpful, and the reason I supported the process to begin with, and I want to thank you for the year of hard work you put into this. I actually think it's a fantastic report and a great blueprint. The city actually does a lot of the things that you are identifying as high-level desirables. We are working hard around employment strategies through the Portland Means Progress Initiative, as you mentioned, and it's an easy dovetail into financial stability and economic justice. So I really like that recommendation. Through Prosper Portland, we're heavily engaged in entrepreneurship and business development, and I hope everybody went to My People's Market last weekend. It was like phenomenal, and there was a line out the door. through transportation. There are efforts ongoing around transit and access to transit through the Housing Bureau, housing opportunities, particularly focused on those who've previously been displaced or impacted by displacement. So that there's bits and pieces of this already taking place, but it's never under the umbrella strategy of economic justice. And, you know, one thing that makes this interesting to me is I spend a lot of time with the Bloomberg administration and the Bloomberg Foundation and Michael Bloomberg, and I will tell you, his government in New York was not at all like the form of government we have here. Similarly, Marty Walsh in Boston has a very different form of government than what we have here. So that sort of top-down centralized leadership is more readily accessible given the way they structure their government, given the way that funds flow within their government. I think we should still do these strategies, and I agree with you that we need in some cases to overcome the fragmentation of our form of government and really be more cohesive in terms of how we outwardly face with nonprofits in the community to develop this larger strategy. And there are clear gaps that are identified in this report where we're not really doing much of anything. And this gets to my old saw. In my former role as state treasurer, I focused on one of the four large components that you mentioned. That was financial literacy. And it got to the very question that you raised, which is it's a life skill to understand credit and debt and how to manage cash flow at the household level. It's a very important life skill, and yet it's taught nowhere. It's not part of our educational curriculum. It used to be when I was, a long time ago in the public school system, and we fought hard with some of your very coalition partners and a number of the people who are on the list, number of organizations, to bring financial literacy schools back to the education system. But it really depended upon three things. It depended on a bank or a credit union or a nonprofit organization coming to the table, and then it required a specific teacher in a specific classroom to say, I want this programming and this curriculum, and it required a principal who would support the teacher in that effort. In other words, there was no interest at the systematic level of taking up financial literacy as a core part of the educational curriculum, and I think it's high time that we do that. And so I think there's an advocacy role that we can play through OGR. I think Commissioner Hardesty is right to raise the question about where is the state on all of this and how do we work with the state? But that's not on you as singularly. I think it's also it's helpful if we have that as part of our agenda to keep pushing it. But I like a lot of pieces of this. I'm very eager to embrace this overall strategy. I'm eager to embrace specific requests that you have within this and see what we can make of it. I think we should do something. I don't think we can just leave this on the table. It's too important because you're right. A lot of the work that we're doing around expungement, a lot of the work we're doing around entrepreneurship, a lot of the work we're doing around housing stability, our umbrella right now is shared economic prosperity. And economic social justice is the twin brother, the twin sister of shared economic prosperity. They're critically important. So I thank you. Colleagues, if there are no further questions, I'll entertain a motion.
Move the report.
Second.
I have a motion from Commissioner Fish, a second from Commissioner Fritz. Any further discussion? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
It's excellent. Carla, please call the roll.
You daily.
Thank you for the presentation. I love this report. I wish I'd been able to participate because this is the kind of like deep dive brainstorming, problem solving, design solutions stuff that I love to do and don't get to do much of, much to my disappointment. I agree with Commissioner Hardesty that the state needs to take the lead on expungement for convictions for things that are no longer crimes. We're doing that at the city level. We don't have enough resources to help everyone that needs that assistance. And it's really a burden that was created by state law. And I've been raising this issue for almost 3 years now, and I will continue to do so. I also want to briefly touch on the impact of petty municipal violations on low-income individuals. We know that a $100 fine can be devastating for someone, and for people who have never lived in or near poverty, that might be unfathomable, but it's absolutely real. I mean, a recent example was TriMet ticketing a homeless 64-year-old man for not tapping his hop card, his unlimited hop card, a $175 fine. That man makes his living selling $1 newspapers on the street. He gets 50 cents, I believe. I could be wrong. It might be a little bit more. I can't do the math that fast in my head, but I think that's around 350 newspapers he'd have to sell to pay that fine. And to me, that's unconscionable. We should not be putting people in that position. And I don't know what will happen with Mr. Rodriguez. He may appeal that fine and prevail, or he may be forced to pay it and decline to pay it because he doesn't have the money. And then it begins to snowball. The fines increase. Anyhow, I just want to point out to my colleagues that 12% of Americans live in poverty, and 40% of Americans are one paycheck away from poverty, one health event away, one unexpected event in their lives away from poverty. And when you live in poverty, you make decisions based on survival that can impact your financial future for years, decades, even the rest of your life. And when you live in poverty, it is really hard to keep hope. And when you don't have hope, you don't have a lot of time and energy to jump through hoops to access services and supports that you're entitled to. And I can speak to that from personal experience, being a low-income mom of a former low-income mother of a child with a disability. We just went without services and supports that my son was entitled to, because on top of my full-time job and caring for my son, I didn't have the time and energy and to complete all of the requirements that were placed upon me to get very things that we really needed and deserved. So I just want to flag that whatever we do moving forward, we need to decrease and eliminate barriers for people living in poverty to these services and supports. If you qualify for food stamps, if your kids qualify for free lunch, why should you have to fill out another stack of papers to qualify for some other needs-based service or support that you will qualify for if you've qualified for something else? Thank you for letting me kind of ramble a little bit. I'm really excited by this report. I think it's just vitally important that we do this work, and I happily vote aye.
Fritz. This is really important work. Thank you for doing it. I apologize for missing the beginning of the presentation. I have a family member with some health issues. Thank you, Mayor, for sponsoring this work and for encouraging the staff to do it. For those who want more information, the report itself is really well written, easy to understand, and very clear in its directives. So thank you for that. Aye.
Bish. Well, thank you for the report, and I thought it was a good discussion. Two thoughts. One is, I think the banks have a big role to play in this work, and I know that one of you mentioned philanthropy and seeking private support. The banks have a huge interest, it seems to me, in financial literacy and empowerment generally, and many of them have programs which are in the schools. I think we should be reaching out to them as partners in this work. But the second thing is, and I listened to the presentation extremely carefully, I've skimmed the report. I'll be honest with you, I just don't know what the next steps are, and that troubles me when we get reports and I leave this room not clear about where we're going. And that's not a criticism of your work, but it is a recurring problem of our work, where lots of laudable ideas come to us, we nod, we thank people, and then nothing happens. And I don't honestly know where this leads. Does this get folded in with 311? Is this something that existing staff tracks? Is this now on the mayor every budget year to come up with a reform that we're going to take up and discuss? I don't know. But if after 10 years of doing this, I don't know, then I'm concerned that this thing may be a well-intentioned exercise funded by a grant, but doesn't go anywhere. So I would urge that we, in the next cycle of work, we really figure out what is actually our role and what can we do in our lane. I know there's a question about whether the county or the city should take the lead on the home. I know there's funding questions and staffing, and that's appropriate. But it would be a shame, given the quality of the work, that we come back a year from now and we're still trying to translate this into what's next. And I've seen that happen so often that I just, you know, I want to just present that as a general concern. And colleagues, I think we also have to sort of think this through and what is a reasonable workload for the city, what is our responsibility. I'm not entirely clear at this point what that is, but it seems to me that should be our next task. Thank you for your good work. Aye.
Hardesty?
Sometimes it doesn't pay to be 4 or 5 because everybody says everything that you wanted to say ahead of time. I want to thank you. Your work is extremely valuable. I think about being a kid in Baltimore, Maryland, and at 8, my mom taking me to the bank and opening up a bank account, right? And so every time I cleaned a house or shoveled snow, or my mom would go through the process of, okay, so this is your fund money and this is what you put in the bank, right? And I think about how valuable that was as a young person, right? And being raised with not a lot of money, it was, it was kind of grilled into us. A couple of things came up. Commissioner Fish mentioned banking, and I thought credit unions should be a really good partner in this program because big banks are about making money and credit unions are about building community. So I think there might be some opportunities there. I share the concern of Commissioner Fish. We get lots of reports and people do great work. And yet, if it's kind of one of these city-county partnerships that the job was to do the report and a report is done, I get a little nervous because I don't immediately see all the components of being necessary, but I don't see a natural home in the city of Portland for a project or program like this. And so doesn't mean that it couldn't happen. It just means that nothing immediately comes to mind that would go, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense and it should be here. I also want to applaud you modeling behavior that I have been trying to push for decades, which is if you want people to come and share their lived experience, you actually have to remove barriers for their participation. And that's transportation, that's food, that's childcare, and it's a stipend so that people aren't paying more to give you their perspective than those of us who have a living wage employment opportunity, right? So I really applaud you at being very intentional about bringing that group together and making sure that they were supported so they could do good work. I'd love to continue the conversation. I'm sure we're gonna figure out something, I hope. I vote aye.
Wheeler.
I just want to add my thanks to Zach from my team and also Prosper Portland for their efforts to help shape the work group, and also to Multnomah County. They participated in this as well. I do see some low-hanging fruit here. I see this report as a baseline, giving us information, identifying some potential strategies, suggesting to us some potential advocacy that we could do, as well as some partnerships that we could forge. And I do think that there are some logical add-ons that have been suggested in this report that I think could strengthen some of the existing work that we're doing in the city, and that's frankly what I'm going to take from this as a next step. Whether we ever get to the bigger vision of creating an office all in New York or Boston, that's probably a decision that will be made with time, but I think there's some immediate strategies that are identified in this report that from my perspective are ones I intend to pursue. So I thank you for the report. I vote aye. The report's accepted. Thanks for your hard work. To be